And so why don't we start when we get a quorum, I'll interrupt and
we'll get a quorum for that meeting,
officially start the meeting. So, Representative Engler has House File 1571.
Nice. And I am the host. We can start testimony, I think, and then when we can get a quorum, we can do it.
Yeah. Here.
So, the Maytag legislator on this bill. You know, it's probably the largest bill of the session, and here I am all lonely with it. But I thought that this bill is an example of how the government works. The governor proposes, and the legislature will dispose. I think at the end of the day, a number of the provisions this bill will be in, and I predict a number of them will not be in the final version. And the department has agreed to come with, what's your fiscal note in this hearing, Mr. Chair? You're a finance chair. You know, we're paying for this hour with all the staff and the audience from the department. Anyway, I can't move the bill, can I, until we have a quorum. So I think if you want to start testimony, that'd be appropriate, and then we can call it to order. I'll move the bill and make my other motion. And okay. So I don't know who's coming first. There's a whole group of people. Mr. Chair, my advice to them was to talk about the policy things that we haven't heard so much about, in language in particular, and we already know the money pretty well. But that's, it's their hour and a half to do what they want with. So I want to introduce my first witness, who will introduce herself.
I'm Jean Wood. I'm with the Department of Human Services.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be starting with Article 1, which is continuing care. I believe that there's an outline that has been provided. Okay. And I'm going to go with the first part of Article 1, which deals with modifying the nursing facility level of care. And that's the first five sections of this particular article covers modifying the nursing facility level of care. This is the threshold that persons eligible for medical assistance must meet in order to access the long-term care benefit. And that benefit is admission to a nursing facility or access to one of the waiver programs connected to the nursing facility level of care. And those are the traumatic brain injury, community alternatives for disabled individuals, and the elderly waiver. This proposal intends to tighten the threshold for the long-term care benefit in order to sustain the program into the future. Current criteria for the level of care are dependent on professional judgment of assessors, and this proposal provides criteria designed to be better quantified and to help assessors with consistency across applicants. Section 3 provides a process for appealing a determination if the individual disagrees with it. Section 4 has the proposed criteria. DHS, in developing this criteria, worked with the national study on level of care in other states and used specifically the level of care processes developed by Vermont and Oregon to help guide its work. Section 33 provides that no one can receive public payment in a nursing facility without having met the nursing facility level of care threshold. Section 42 applies the threshold to the alternative care program, and sections 47 to 49 apply that threshold to people applying for CADI and TBI. Section 39 discusses essential community services grants. Capped at $400 per month per person, this grant would pay for a limited benefit set of four services along with care coordination for persons no longer for any medical assistance services because they did not meet the nursing home level of care threshold. Section 42 and 43 clarifies that for the alternative care program that private accident or health insurance should be the first payer for services including equipment and supplies. As a part of modifying the nursing facility level of care, there also is a language on a comprehensive assessment. This proposal puts in place this comprehensive assessment, which we call COMPASS, along with training and certification of those assessors, and clarification of the elements that make up the range of information and assistance available to persons planning for long-term care services. The COMPASS would take the place of four current assessments: the long-term care consultation, the personal care attendant assessment, the developmental disability screening, and the private duty nursing assessment. Section 11 updates language to reflect the provision of long-term care options service by the Senior Linkage Line as a service that does not require the COMPASS, available through either telephone, online through MinnesotaHelp.info, or in person. It isn't the eligibility process that they are going through, but a navigating service assisting people at an earlier stage in making decisions about long-term care services. Sections 24 through 34 update the long-term care consultation by clarifying that a long-term care consultation is available to any person regardless of public program eligibility, requires coordination of that consultation with the Senior Linkage Line and Disability Linkage Line, and that tribal organizations may also provide the long-term care consultation as already provided by law. These sections also place references of the proposed nursing facility level of care in needed areas, minimizes the number of business processes, requires automation, and requires the department to develop an alternative payment method for the long-term care consultation. More specifically, Section 25 modernizes the definition of long-term care consultation to remove the requirement of providing general information. This general information provision about long-term care services has, by practice, become the role of the Linkage Line, and as a part of long-term care option counseling, a service of the Linkage Lines and of MinnesotaHelp.info. Sections 26 through 28 describe the qualifications of an assessor, their training and certification. Section 29 puts in place after January 1, 2011, that all lead agencies will use certified assessors, and those assessments will be done within 15 calendar days of the request, and assures that assessors shall not be a provider of services nor have a financial interest in the provision of services, thus eliminating a conflict.
We could just interrupt for a minute. Members, we do have a quorum, so I'll call the meeting to order, and Representative Pepin has spent at least 45 minutes reading the minutes, and would she like to move approval?
I'm sure that would show that she needs remedial reading.
I will move the minutes.
Representative Pepin moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. The minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Pepin. Wood, why don't you continue our representative?
I think I'll move the bill. If I could do the amendment, then we can discuss the bill as it will be. This bill would be moved to, I don't think, consent calendar, I was thinking. Actually be held over for possible whatever later on.
Inclusion in the omnibus bill.
I think the whatever is quite closer. But, and Mr. Chair, if I could move the A1-1 amendment, and I have an oral amendment I need to offer to that. On page 289, get the bill and we'll discuss it, so I might save some time. So on the first oral amendment, I apologize for that. It just kind of
Mr. Chair and members, normally we have a 24-hour rule if it's a complicated amendment, but if somebody is just going to delete a section, I don't think we need the 24-hour rule. So Representative Abler talked to me yesterday, and I agreed that he could do these deletes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I'll just, to give you the language, then I'll go through and describe the amendments. Page 85, delete line 85.1. I can get these to staff if you want. And page 289, delete section 35 of Article 11. And, Mr. Chair, these are things I just can't imagine we're going to do anyway. There's been strong disagreement with these elements, and these were put in to balance the budget, and nobody I've talked to agrees that these are where we should go. So on the first three elements are the fraud moved to the state. Line 1.5 is the brokering STF. Line 1.6 is the elimination of podiatry, therapy, and chiropractic. 1.7 is the elimination of OT, speech, and dental. The 85.1 is the epilepsy grants, which actually save money. And then the other one is the hearing aid dispenser fees that are way too high. So I would move that amendment, and just to get the bill in order so we can discuss it from this point.
Representative Abler moves the amendment. Is there any discussion? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to follow along. This was an oral amendment that he's moving separately from the amendment in front of us.
No.
Separate from the A1 amendment. I'm confused.
Mr. Chair, I incorporated two more lines into my amendment. So. I meant to incorporate those.
They're incorporated into this?
Yeah, to incorporate those into the amendment. So the amendment now is before us as I would have amended it.
So we're amending the amendment right now, I guess.
Well, I could incorporate that in my amendment. So yeah. I'd incorporate
the author have his amendment the way he wants it. Again, these are all our deletions, so there's really nothing that you would have had to have read other than the bill, which I haven't read either. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, I hope Representative Abel, are you planning on talking about the rest of the deletions too in the amendment?
I just went through the list.
But we went through the whole list on the A1 amendment?
That's all there are. So.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay, so he's incorporated the oral amendments into the amendment. Now he's moving the A1 amendment, which has a number of deletions. Any discussion of that? Seeing none, all those in favor of the Abler Amendment A1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative, sorry, just as a preliminary matter, this is the governor's original proposal from January. And is the process going to be he's going to amend this bill, or is he going to submit another budget bill, or do we not know?
We do not know, and if we get done in time here, we can all run over to his presentation of his new budget. But it's my intent to have a separate omnibus budget bill. And so if there's parts of this bill that we like, they will be amended into that one. Ms. Wood.
Okay, the next section deals with the customized living rate setting in the elderly waiver, commonly called assisted living. Section 35 clarifies the rate setting policy for bundled rate for customized living is comprising component services and sets the maximum rate at the maximum rate of each of these service components. Section 36 gives parallel language for the 24-hour customized living service. Section 36 also lays out an alternative and simplified rate setting methodology for smaller housing with service establishments, those with 10 residents and under. Section 36 limits the rates for 24-hour customized living for those at the top of the rate to the 95th percentile. This is a budget saving proposal, and Section 38 applies this rate reduction to contracts with managed care organizations and requires them to implement these reductions effective January 1, 2010. Section 11 uses the Uniform Consumer Information Guide as the structure to collect housing and services costs across service types, including housing with services through all home and community-based services. This information would be made available for easy comparison by potential consumers and would be posted on the web and be readily available regardless of source of payment for the services. The next section is the elimination of certain grants. This proposes to eliminate certain continuing care grants. In section 57 and the repealer, it eliminates the Region 10 Quality Assurance Commission funding. And then in the rider section of the appropriations article, there is a delay in this biennium for the return of $240,000 in community service development grant funds. The next section is uncodified language. Section 54 has uncodified language that sets out a working group that will look at the CCSA out of funding. It would take the next year to agree to a county funding allocation and priorities for the Protecting Adults Act. This addresses the use of funding to the adult population from the Children and Community Services Act. This work group will clarify and strengthen the use of these funds for the benefit of vulnerable adults. Children's and Families Administration is bringing forward a proposal for another portion of this fund dedicated to children, as is chemical and mental health. I am done.
Okay. Please stand for questions.
Ms. Wood, the modifying the nursing facility level of care, have you looked into whether that's possible under the stimulus package?
We have asked that question, and we have not received final guidance from CMS, and so we are unable at this point to answer the question. You know, we are we're going to continue to pursue doing the modification until we're told otherwise.
Who knows how long that's going to take? We don't have a commissioner of HHS and we don't have a director of the CMS right now.
Mm-hmm. You know, they keep promising us group telephone calls, and then they cancel them and reschedule them. So we're anxiously awaiting the word.
Okay, any other questions for Ms. Wood? Seeing none, we can continue on. For members, most of this is a redo of the change pages that we've already discussed, so if you really want to see most of these things, they're in the change pages.
My name is Alex Fotalik, Mr. Chair and members. I'm going to start with an overview of the PCA redesign and provider standards. In addition to changes that I will highlight, an effort was made to simplify the statutes by orienting sections by home care service for easier reference. But right now it's a little complicated because there's a number of strikeouts and deletes as we're trying to do that. The first section on the outline is 256B.0625, which covers general MA service definitions. And the major change is the requirement for two or more activities of daily living to access PCA services. In addition, the physician's statement of need is eliminated, and there's reference later in the statute to promoting better communication and earlier communication during the assessment process between the physician and the assessor. 0.06353, and I'm just going to orient you to some of the sections, covers home health services. 0.0654 covers private duty nursing. And 0655 covers PCA services. This section requires supervision of PCA services by a qualified professional, and it changes the home care ratings that have been used. Authorizations for PCA are based on the new home care ratings, the number of complex health needs and behavioral issues. 0.0659 is a new section, and this section now consolidates the provisions of PCA services as we go forward. It offers further clarification of the 8 activities of daily living that are used to look at a person's need for PCA services, and it defines complex health needs and behavioral criteria which are used in authorizing hours. It speaks to effective communication with the physician. It defines the duties of a responsible party who acts on the behalf of someone who cannot direct their own care. And it includes a provision that the responsible party will live with the recipient. As we move down the outline of provisions, we're moving into those that are focusing on strengthening the integrity of the program through enrollment standards and training. Training is required for all PCA agencies and individual PCAs who provide this service. There's a limit on the number of hours that a PCA can work and be reimbursed in a given month. There are annual assurances of compliance with enrollment standards and restrictions on re-enrollment if an agency was terminated. There are standardized documentation requirements, and the last provision allows additional time for the transition of recipients that are affected by some of the proposed changes. The next section I'm going to address are provisions for federal compliance for the home and community based.
So I could just interrupt on the PCA services. Does any of that change reflect what the legislative auditor recommended?
Yes. Many of the sections around training, around standardizing some of the guidelines to make it easier for people to determine authorized hours, there's a number of things, particularly in integrity, that are reflections of the OLA.
Thank you.
I'll continue, Mr. Chair. The next section are the provisions for the federal compliance for the home and community-based waivers. And these are covered in several sections. I'm going to speak to them all at once. And it covers sections 8 through 10, 40, and 51. We made a commitment, DHS made a commitment, to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services to make changes in three areas of waiver administration in order to continue approval. One was to develop statewide consistent service rate setting methodologies. Second was to develop a statewide consistent provider enrollment process without lead agency contracts. And the third was to continue to develop a comprehensive quality improvement infrastructure. The proposed language in these sections gives the state the authority to establish agreements with providers and regularly review provider qualifications. It requires background studies for all waiver staff that provide direct service, and it develops statewide rate setting methodologies. I want to point out that the rate setting methodologies can differ depending upon the service, and it may be that there are rate edit limits or maximums, and that there are state-developed methodologies for individualized rates that are based on individual characteristics and other factors that are developed. Next, I'm going to move into provisions for the budget proposal limiting waiver growth. We've had limits on growth in the past, and in order to allow a level of growth and still achieve savings, the governor is proposing a moratorium on the development of what's been called shift staff model of corporate foster care. It's not sustainable for us to continue to rely on the foster care shift staff model to the extent that we have. The proposal does not eliminate existing shift staff foster homes, but it does prevent the growth of this model when paid for through a waiver. By reducing the cost of services, we're able to achieve savings without severe limits in waiver growth. The language gives the state the authority to put a moratorium on new child and adult foster care licenses where the location is not the primary residence of the license holder, and it also provides exceptions to the moratorium. It manages the capacity of this type of residential setting at the state level, reports to the legislature about the effect of the moratorium. There's language establishing a new license that integrates the service standards and the standards for the residential setting under one license, and it establishes a new service under the disability waivers for the residential services that are provided in this type of setting. Lastly, in Section 55, there's a 3% rate reduction for all long-term care service providers except nursing facilities. Section 52 has the 3% reduction for ICF-SMR, and Section 53 removes the rate increase encumbrance that was placed in previous years. And so if there's questions, I'm happy to answer it. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Bob Held to discuss provisions for nursing facilities.
See any questions? So thank you for your testimony, and Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, I'm Bob Held from the Department of Human Services. There's four provisions related to nursing homes that I will describe. The first one is in Section 44, and this addresses the plan closure rate adjustments, and it resets the method by which the amount of those adjustments is determined. moves us away from the negotiated method that's currently in place and uses the original method of using $2,080 per bed closed as a plan closure rate adjustment factor. The next section is section 45, which addresses a change in the policy for paying for single bed rooms for people on medical assistance. The current policy only pays for those beds if those single bed rooms if there's medical necessity for it. This proposal eliminates that requirement of medical necessity and says that we would pay for those rooms for any medical assistance recipient who's in a single bed room, and it reduces the amount that we would pay from 15% of their average rate to 10%. It's a dollar savings proposal, and as with the plan closure one, it's an administrative simplification proposal for both facilities and for the department. The next section is section 46, which ends the implementation of the rebasing formula of setting nursing facility payment rates. It says simply that the phase-in that has occurred would stay in place, but any further phase-in would cease. And the final section is in section 57, a repealer, which has two provisions that are repealed related to the intergovernmental transfer. The 256D19 subdivision 1D is the area, the section that creates the nursing facility intergovernmental transfer, and 256B431 subdivision 23 is the section that provides for supplemental MA payments to the counties after they've made the intergovernmental transfer. And those are both repealed.
Mr. Held, could you go back to the single bed payment policy? What is the current policy on single beds?
The current policy is that a facility has a person they identify as needing a single bedroom for medical necessity, the person's on medical assistance. In some circumstances, the facility is permitted to request this 15% increase. They have to provide a doctor's order and other documentation to demonstrate that the person has medical necessity for a single bedroom. So that's the current policy. There's currently about 2,000 people on medical assistance in single bedrooms for medical necessity, and currently about a little over 10,000 of our beds are single bedrooms out of 33,000 or so. This would make that available to everybody on MA, but not require the medical necessity, this proposal.
And the above the multi-room rate would be 10%?
The increase would be 10%, yes. Instead of 15, which is why it's a money savings proposal.
And for members that don't know, this is the one place in single bedrooms where we don't have rate equalization. Every place else in a nursing home, if there's more than one bed in a room, the private pay people are charged the same as the public pay people. But in a single room, they can charge whatever they can get. But we will only pay for our clients if this passes 10% more.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions?
I could just add some more of the bill if you'd like, Mr. Chair.
We were wondering now, what's next? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Chuck Johnson, Department of Human Services. Articles 2 through 7 of the bill deal with children, family, and services. Most of the changes that are in Articles 2 through 5 are pretty straightforward implementation of the budget changes I described a couple of weeks ago. So I'd like to use the time by starting talking first about Articles 6 and 7, which I believe start on page 111 of the bill. These are the two articles that cover the Protecting Children and Strengthening Families Act and the North Star Care for Children. Move us forward in the child welfare area in terms of early and effective intervention with families, addressing racial disparities, improving performance in the system, and promoting permanency for children who are removed from the home. I'd like to ask Aaron Sullivan Sutton, Director of Child Safety and Permanency, to walk us through those parts of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Aaron Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Director of the Division of Child Safety and Permanency at DHS, and I will walk you through Articles 6 and 7. And before I do that, I do want to mention that most of what we are doing here is making recommendations to use money that's currently being spent in the child welfare system in a more effective manner and in a manner that is likely to improve outcomes for children and families served. Article 6 of the bill would be new legislation under a Protecting Children and Strengthening Families Act. This proposal would outline outcomes that the child welfare system is intended to achieve in terms of meeting the needs of children and families, and would identify what are the services that ought to be provided by counties to that end. Sections 1 to 3 simply provide the framework for the Protecting Children's Act and identifies the priorities for our child welfare system. Section 4 provides a definition of terms that are used in the Act and provides a definition of a continuum of services to be provided by counties in meeting the needs of kids and families. Section 5 identifies priority uses for priority use of the money, from serving and supporting families to safely maintain their children in the home, and the last priority being out-of-home care. We want to keep kids safely with their families whenever possible and direct resources to that end. Section 6 of the bill identifies the responsibilities of the commissioner, including allocation of funds and requirement that the commissioner maintain a quality assurance system that measures and reports county and state performance on the measures that are provided for. There's also provision for counties to develop program improvement plans, which they currently do now in any areas that they're not meeting federal and state standards, and our responsibility to work with them to continually work towards improving outcomes, as I mentioned earlier. Section 7 provides for a development of biennial plans, which is currently done by the counties through the Community Services Act. And Section 8 provides an allocation formula in which over a period of 5 years, we would be redistributing the funds from a historical basis to a basis that's based on performance, percentage share of child maltreatment reports, and caseloads. And then Section 9 has to do with the language that's currently in the Child and Community Services Act regarding responsibilities of county boards in reporting, et cetera. And this bill would become effective January 1, 2011. If there's not any questions on Article 6, I will move to Article 7, which is a proposal regarding what we're calling North Star Care for Children. And before I get into pointing to the certain sections, I do want to give you a brief overview of what is intended to be accomplished here. Currently, we have 3 programs for supporting children in out-of-home care. We have foster care that's provided to foster parents who are caring for children on a temporary basis. We have a fairly high foster care rate. We also have a relative custody assistance program that provides a little bit of assistance, about half of what would be available to the family on foster care, to relatives who accept permanent legal responsibility for children for whom they're caring. And then we have a third program, adoption assistance, which is, again, about half of what was available to the family when they were providing foster care. But adoption assistance is available when families accept or adopt children with special needs. And what we are trying to do here is align these 3 programs into one program that's somewhere in the middle that would provide for a stable benefit for children as they move from temporary foster care to permanence with a relative or an adoptive family. So with that, I will walk through sections of the North Star bill. It looks fairly complicated, but a lot of this is really steady point with the procedures for the new program, and it would be consistent with procedures and policies within our existing program. The first four sections of the bill are purely technical. Sections 5, 6, and 7 set forth the framework for the new North Star Care for Children and identifies as public policy the need to provide stability in benefits available to support children in out-of-home care. Section 7 is simply a definitional section that incorporates existing definitions within our current programs. Section 8 provides the framework for the program as we move forward, and we get into most of the details in sections 9, 10, and 11. Section 9 refers to the foster care portion, section 10 refers to guardianship assistance, and section 11 refers to adoption assistance. Under section 9, there's provisions that children who are currently in foster care would transition to the new program effective January 1, 2011. And the section also defines the eligibility criteria, including that there be an agency placement either through a voluntary placement agreement or through a support order. Section 10 deals with guardianship assistance to relatives who assume permanent legal responsibility. This would allow Minnesota to access the newly available Title 40 federal guardianship assistance to meet the needs of this population, and we would terminate the current relative custody assistance program, which is funded with TANF and state funding. But this provision would require that there be a permanent transfer of custody to a relative, that the child had lived with a relative for 6 months, and that the child, that there be the normal background checks are part of the process as well, and that the child be a resident of Minnesota. Section 11 has similar provisions with respect to children who are, special needs children who are adopted. There would have to be a determination that they have in fact special needs. Background study requirements would continue to exist, and there's also provisions for when the benefit would terminate under both actually adoption as well as guardianship assistance, and the limited situations where benefits could continue beyond a child's 18th birthday. There's also provisions to be clear that both with guardianship assistance and adoption assistance, that those agreements are negotiated between the parent assuming permanent responsibility and the county or state agency. Section 12 calls for an assessment process which looks at the needs of the child as well as the ability of the caregiver to meet those needs. Right now there are different assessment processes across the three different programs, and this would create one process that would provide consistency regardless of a child's legal status. Section 13 of the bill provides the benefits available to the children across the three programs. There is a basic monthly rate based on three different age groups, and then a supplemental level that's available that can meet the needs of children at 10 different levels. Section 4 is language regarding who pays for the cost of North Star. The federal share is borne through Title 40 foster care and adoption assistance dollars, and the state and county would share the non-federal share of the cost based on historical studies. And Section 15 provides for the administrative procedures for North Star, including responsibility for conducting the assessments, determine eligibility, and the like. And Sections 16, 17, and 18 would repeal the existing relative custody assistance program, as I mentioned earlier. There are a number of sections that are, actually Sections 19 to 50, are conforming amendments in the adoption statute that would be necessary to come in line with the provisions of the North Star proposal and to administer the program. I think you have a summary of the individual amendments, so I won't spend any time going over those in detail. Finally, as I mentioned, the program would become effective January 1, 2011. And if there's any questions, I would be happy to take them.
Any questions? I must say this is March 17th, and for a witness named Aaron Sullivan Sutton, we have brought down the shamrock.
They're gorgeous.
Any other questions? Mr. Johnson, did you?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to give you a very quick version of Articles 2 through 5. Article 2 relates to the UNSA program, actually the first four sections of child care assistance, which some of the jurisdiction of the Early Ed Committee. Starting with Section 5, our provisions dealing with UNSA. These address the changes that we discussed when we walked through the budget pages, the reinstatement of counting $125 of SSI, increase in counting of housing from $50 to $100, the reduction in the exit level from 115 to 110% of poverty, increasing the value or decreasing the value of a car for asset limits from $15,000 to $7,500, as well as reinstating the 20-hour work requirement for post-secondary education. In addition, there's a change here that aligns our MSIF and diversionary work program eligibility so that we don't have people in diversionary work program also on family stabilization services. We're also asking for authority here to change the MFIP transitional standard whenever there's a change made to the food stamp program. Right now the law reads we can do that in October, which is usually when changes are made to the food stamp program. The stimulus bill is making a change in April, and we actually don't have the authority to do that, so we need to get that clarified so we can change whenever the food stamp level changes. There are also changes in here related to the MFIP consolidated fund, proposed reduction by the governor to reduce that by 5%. And removing the corresponding language that was weakened a couple of years ago, which used to connect performance to that 5% of the money. Article 3 addresses adult support programs. This includes the combining of emergency general assistance and emergency Minnesota supplemental aid into a single emergency program for adults. It also gives the counties more flexibility around that and also creates an eligibility limit of 200% of poverty. This section, this article also includes several sections that align our overpayment recovery policy, which results in a small savings and a simplification and streamlining of programs, and also includes the reduction to the personal needs allowance for some GRH recipients that I discussed on the budget page, down to $89 a month, which is the MA standard, and also the elimination of the GRH community living adjustment. Article 4 is fraud prevention, sections 1, 3, and 5 were, I believe, eliminated in the office amendment.
Representative Abler, did you have a question?
Are any of these changes that have been proposed here not allowed by taking the stimulus money, or are all these eligibility changes putting the money from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, there is nothing in the stimulus law. Of the things I've talked about, the only stimulus money I believe is related would be in TANF, and there's nothing in the TANF stimulus law that would prevent us from making any of these changes.
And Mr. Chair, maybe as the different departments come down, if they point out what was in the governor's original bill that was not doable based upon the maintenance effort requirement from the, based upon getting the enhanced match and all that, as this go on, just to point it.
I actually had a question for Ms. Sutton as well. On the child protection, again, there's stimulus money, but does that go directly to counties and the group don't have any control over it?
Mr. Chairman, there is an FMAP increase in foster care maintenance, which would go to counties, and then there's a FMAP rate for adoption assistance that goes to the state adoption assistance program.
Chair, just two more issues. In Article 4, there is language that allows us to consolidate public assistance appeals with the DHS appeals referees when revenue recapture is involved. This is currently something that requires two separate appeals to take place. We're trying to streamline and make it more efficient. And Article 5 addresses child support. There's one single thing that's done across the four sections here, which is that currently there's a requirement that we have to administratively add on 20% to a child support order when we're doing income withholding if there are arrears outstanding. We have to do that regardless of whether the child support order from the judge has already included consideration of the arrears. This would say we only have to add in the 20% when the judge has not addressed arrears in the order. If the judge addressed arrears, that would stand as the way arrears would be paid.
Any questions? Well, thank you for your testimony. And who's next?
Mr. He likes lots of questions. I hope you read carefully what he's talking about.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Jerry Kerber. I'm the Director of the Licensing Division of the Department of Human Services, and I'm going to take, I was told I have 3 minutes to talk about Article 8. First of all, there are no changes to Article 8, and nothing in addition to what we talked about a couple weeks ago when talking about the change pages. Article 8 is about licensing fees, and in two different fees in particular. One is related to background studies, and one is related to the fees we charge of licensed programs. In Article 8, there are 18 sections. Section 1 is an attempt to correct just a technical amendment from 2007 when some background studies responsibilities were transferred from the counties to the state, and so this is merely taking away the county fee for those background studies because they're done by the state now. Sections 2 through 16 talk about the fees that we will charge of licensed programs on an annual basis. And you may recall what we're trying to accomplish here in this proposal is to establish the licensing division within the Department of Human Services in a fashion that's more like the health department or other licensing agencies of state government, where the fees that are collected are they're recovering about the cost of doing the work. Chapter 16A says that if you charge a fee for a regulatory activity, it should be pretty close to recovering the actual cost. And so what we're trying to do here is to just balance that out. A lot of the licensing fees that we collect fall far short than from what the actual general fund appropriation is. And so in sections 2 through 16, they're addressing the individual different types of licenses that we issue. Section 17 is where that funding relationship then gets changed from the general fund to the state government special revenue fund. And so the fees that we collect for our licensing fees would be deposited into the state government special revenue fund, and out of that fund we would get our appropriation for that licensing activity. Section 18 is a background study fee that I mentioned, and this is proposing that we start charging a fee for background studies that we do for private adoption agencies. We would raise about $440,000 a year, we're anticipating with that. Mr. Chair, that's Article 8. Do you have any questions?
Mr. Chair, just
questions. Representative Edwards.
I think some of the stuff you might actually do, especially Section 1, which has to do with the counties, the state doing some checks. But there's a technical amendment which isn't ready for that section, assuming it goes forward. So just to give you a heads up.
Mr. Service. Okay, any other? Thank you, Mr. Kerber.
Thank you.
Yeah. Jim, what was your comment? I was talking and I missed what you said.
Article 8, Section 1 transfers the responsibility from background studies to the state from the county. And if that happens, we need a technical amendment later to clarify that counties can still do some other things. So it's real minor. I don't have it prepared for today. I didn't bring any amendments besides the leasings today. So we'll see if you even want to do it, and then we'll talk about the amendment.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Member Santa McMahon from the Department of Human Services Healthcare Administration. We distributed a crosswalk of all of the budget pages based on the order that Mr. Osberg went through when he presented the budget pages to the committee. So we've walked through all of the sections of Article 9 affect the various budget pages. And then here with me are two of my colleagues from the Healthcare Eligibility and Access Division. They're going to talk specifically to the healthcare simplification proposal that was discussed back when Mr. Osberg presented the budget pages.
Mr. Chair, Karen Gibson with the Department of Human Services. By way of background on the healthcare program simplification proposal, there are currently three programs which comprise the Minnesota healthcare programs. They are medical assistance, Minnesota care, and general assistance medical care. We have developed and evolved over 40 years, and quite a bit of complexity has been added to those programs over the years. The current eligibility and enrollment system needs to be restructured to ensure client access, efficiently implement policy changes, and better use administrative resources. The system's complexity was highlighted by the Office of the Legislative Auditor in a 2007 report. In response, the legislature established an advisory committee and identified ways to simplify and streamline human services and administrative requirements. By way of simplifying the healthcare programs, the governor's budget proposal would eliminate duplicative coverage on Minnesota Care for pregnant women and children under age 2, children 2 through 18 with income at or below 150% of federal poverty guidelines, and children ages 19 to 20 with income at or below 100% of the federal poverty guidelines. Currently, these populations are covered under medical assistance. These changes would be effective July 1, 2011, or upon federal approval, whichever is later. Minnesota Care coverage for children in those age groups would continue above those income levels specified up to 275% of poverty. The proposal also aligns certain Minnesota Care eligibility rules with the eligibility rules for MA for families and children, including changing the income methodology and implementing six-month reviews for Minnesota Care. Again, the changes would be effective July 1, 2011, or upon federal approval. Additionally, the proposal has some compliance issues based on the terms of the Minnesota Care waiver renewal, which was recently approved. They include an expedited MA eligibility determination for certain families disenrolled from Minnesota Care for failure to pay premium.
Mr. Chair,
if I could just ask a question there for Mr. Gibson. Is there federal money available to do the computer part of the simplification?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, as far as I know, there is money of federal funds available to do that.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Troy Mangan with the Department of Human Services, Healthcare Eligibility and Access Division. Another component of our program simplification proposal is implementing a statewide support unit for long-term care eligibility. This is an effort to increase our capacity within the Department of Human Services to be able to deal with the ever-increasing, increasingly complex financial and legal instruments that counties are having to deal with. County workers are having to make legal decisions or rely on the county attorneys to make decisions around trusts and other instruments. This part of the bill will allow us to increase our capacity in those areas to be able to provide more consistent advice to counties in those areas. Part of that proposal also includes a certification for long-term care eligibility workers so that we can ensure that all individuals who are processing long-term care cases have the appropriate level of knowledge and experience to be able to process those cases effectively and efficiently.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Tuffner. I'm the State Operating Services Chief Executive Officer for the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to speak to Article 10 and then dropping to Articles 15 and 16. And beside me,
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Dan Storkamp, the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. I'll also be talking about Section 10, Sections 8 through 16, and then also join in Mike Fisner's discussion on 15 and 16 articles.
Okay, beginning with Article 10, Sections 1 through 7, this modifies the way that State Operated Services would be creating bills for services. The current structure, the cost of care structure, was put in place decades ago
prior to things like health insurance and eligibility for health insurance inside of our system. Over the last couple of years, we've developed considerable community-based hospital level of care out in the healthcare system that really needs to be able to build rates, work with insurance companies, work with patients and their ability to pay, just like any other healthcare provider would do. What the language in sections 1 through 7 does is essentially allow us to build rates and treat patients and insurance companies the way every other healthcare provider does.
Mr. Chair and members, sections 8 through 16 is the Minnesota Sex Offender Change, where all we're doing is taking language that was currently under the State Operated Services section of the law and moving it under a new MSOP section of law. This helps us separate the two areas, MSOP and SOS. So it's just a technical change.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, moving down to Articles 15 and 16. This is the CERP proposal, which we've talked about in this committee previously. Essentially what it does for state-operated services, in particular the MEDO program and the Minnesota Security Hospital, as well as MSOP, and moves essentially the staff who aren't primarily responsible for security would no longer be eligible for the CERP, the Correctional Employees Retirement Plan, moves them into the General Retirement Plan.
That part is actually in the jurisdiction of the pension committee, whatever the title of that is. So we don't have to fight with that issue. Next, Denise. Thank you. Oh, I have just one question for Ms. Tevner. The facility in Carlton County that was a women's only chemical dependency treatment facility that had some, is that permanently gone to Brainerd, or is there a hope of bringing that back?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that program, it's the Liberalis Care program operated out of Carlton, operates on the enterprise side along with five other chemical dependency programs throughout the state. Over the course of the last 9 months, there's been a substantial downturn in utilization across our system, which has forced us, essentially, we have 50 beds staffed without patients in them on any given day, which has caused us, if you recall, on the enterprise side, our obligation is to operate within the revenues available. So if there's growth in it, we grow, and if there's not, then we shrink. At this point, the best business decision, given that 50-bed gap, is to consolidate the Liberalis program from Carlton over to Brainerd. What that does is it pulls about 50 beds offline, stabilizes the Brainerd program, stabilizes Liberalis, so that we continue providing those services. Now, having said that, we are meeting with the counties in the Northeast to talk about perhaps alternative solutions this Friday. So that proposal to consolidate those programs at present is on hold.
If I understood it right, the facility is for women only, and that the people that work there are also female. Is that, or was? Is it, and how does that relate to what's going on in Brainerd then?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, essentially that would be intact and simply relocated to the Brainerd site. So it would still serve women only, staffed by women only.
Okay, because I've heard that they have an outstanding record of providing treatment to these women that may not be available in a heterosexual environment.
Mr. Chair, they do have an outstanding record. This program's been in existence for well over 20 years now, has served many, many, many women well. Our intent in this move is to stabilize the financial situation so we can continue that work.
And is the facility in Brainerd, is it separated from the other facilities that's there?
Mr. Chair, we have the ability in the Brainerd site to make that separation. It isn't presently, but if we go through with this move, we will make a physical separation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, John Zachel from Chemical and Mental Health Services. My understanding is that you're not doing the health department sections today.
That's correct. We'll wait for those tomorrow.
Okay, so we'll skip on to Article 13 then. You should have a single sheet crosswalk that connects the Article 10 that Mr. Tessner just talked about, as well as Article 13 with the governor's budget pages. It's the landscape sheet with some grid lines on it.
This is it. Mental health?
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Mine's green.
Oh.
Must be St. Patrick's.
Great. Okay. So the first part of Article 13 is actually a number of sections that relate to Governor's Budget Page 83, which was the Child Mental Health Residential Treatment Restructuring Page. That involves four main components that affect intensive services for children. The first part is directed specifically at children's mental health residential treatment, what are known as Rule 5 facilities, and specifically for when those services are needed by children who are in prepaid health plans. Currently, responsibility for the placement is divided between the county and the health plan, and this provision buys out the remaining county share and simplifies the decision-making process so that the child can receive the services that they need in a more timely manner. That particular provision costs the state $1.8 million, but it saves the county an equal amount. That money is coming out of the next provision, which delays medical assistance coverage for a new children's mental health service called Treatment Foster Care. That service is proposed to be delayed in Section 9 by 2 years. And that has the effect of saving $5 million. Of that $5 million, about $3 million is going to the budget deficit, and the rest is going to the other parts of this budget page, which you see in the sections laid out here. The third part of that budget page uses a small amount of those savings to provide some flexibility to counties in how they provide children's mental health crisis services, which we hope will lead to increased availability of those services. And then the fourth part equalizes the rates for children's partial hospitalization services to make them comparable to the adult rates. Let's move on to the next section. Okay. The next sections relate to budget page, which was talked about earlier, page 41, the Protecting Children Act. If you recall, that related to the Children and Community Services Act block grant, which on page 41 is proposed to be divided among the various vulnerable populations that are served by those funds. This addresses the parts of that block grant that would go to chemical and mental health services. Section 3 of Article 13 describes how those funds will be used for detoxification services. And Section 14 describes the process for developing an allocation process for the adult and children's mental health part of those funds. Moving on, we have a number of sections, 4 through 7, that relate to Budget Page 85, which is the reform of the payment system for chemical dependency providers. One piece about this page that's new since we presented the budget page is that we have since received clear direction from CMS, the federal agency, that these are changes that we have to make if we are to continue receiving Medicaid share for chemical dependency treatment. We are being told that we have to move away from county negotiated rates and county contracts for these services. It's very similar to what was described earlier for waiver services. And so what these sections do is they lay out the process for developing a statewide rate setting methodology for chemical dependency treatment. And then finally, the last section 12 relates to page 89, which is a delay of some new mental health services, specifically assertive community treatment for adolescents. This service is a new service that hasn't started yet, and by delaying it for a year, It saves about $2 million to help address the budget deficit. Any questions?
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there any other testimony from the Department of Human Services? As I said, we are going to hear the Department of Health section's governor's bill tomorrow. So if there's no further discussion,
Chair, you want to ask people
you want to renew your motion?
If I could lay it, move to lay it on the table pending tomorrow, or just you would hold it over until tomorrow.
Lay it on the table, and then we'll bring it up tomorrow and hear the health department stuff, and then we'll
through the bill.
Lay it over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So with that, this bill is laid on the table until tomorrow, and we will adjourn the meeting. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you.